I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The US is facing a government shutdown as Republican lawmakers try a last-ditch effort to defund the Affordable Care Act. To talk about this and other issues in national, state and local politics, I'll speak with 90.7 commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Also, more than 60,000 children in Florida have an incarcerated parent. To help them cope with the sadness, anxiety and confusion of having a parent behind bars, the Florida Department of Corrections enlisted the help of Sesame Street and its program Little Children, Big Challenges. I'll speak with representatives from the Department of Corrections and Sesame Street about the program and how it's helping parents and children in Florida. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Lou Fry is a former Republican congressman. He's the founder of the Lou Fry Institute for Politics and Government at the University of Central Florida. Nice to see you again, Lou.
Good to be back.
And also Dick Batchelor, he's the former Democratic State House representative, and he's also the founder and president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Dick, thanks for coming along.
It's good to be back.
All right, well, it's shaping up to be a chaotic week on Capitol Hill with issues of government funding, the debt ceiling, and Obamacare on the agenda of lawmakers. Some Republicans are backing plans to pass a temporary budget bill that defunds Obamacare, while others are standing by a government shutdown until Obamacare is repealed. Lou Fry, what say you to this? What are the chances that any of these measures pass?
Well, unfortunately, there is some chance. The Republicans have got a firing squad. It's circular. And here's the thing, I think, as a member of Congress, you got to look at. There are votes that come up, you know, where your party wants you to vote this way and that way. But then there's some votes that really have an incredible impact, and you've got to look at not as your oath, not that you took an oath as a Republican or a Democrat, but to go and defend the Constitution, preserve, protect, and defend it. And what will happen to the country if we get in a mess and get in a roadblock over Obamacare? The country is going to suffer. We're going to have a problem internationally with it. We're going to have the market go to heck in that. And I just think it just doesn't make any sense. Get your fight. Have your say. Obamacare can't pass. It's got to get a bill through, and the president's got to sign. So you're wasting your time, valuable time and energy, on something that won't be. I have no problem people doing it politically, but it comes a point where you got to say, hey, look, enough's enough. We're starting back in this country. We're making a little progress. My 401k now is, instead of a 101k, it's maybe a 201k. You know, things are coming back in the right direction. But if you shut the government down, it doesn't work. 1995, what was that fellow's name from Georgia?
Newt Gingrich.
And, you know, so the Republicans, well, it's great. You give the guys a chance to have their say in that. But once that say is over, move on with the bigger issues that are facing our country, including the debt ceiling, which we have to raise.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dick Batchelor, let me ask you, are we going to see a government shutdown, even a partial shutdown, do you think, come October 1st?
Possibly, because unfortunately, Speaker Boehner has allowed himself to be hijacked, if not taken hostage, by some Ted Cruz in the Senate and others who just really are threatened to shut the government down. Which, by the way, would be the worst thing, as Lou alluded to, for the Republicans, because Newt Gingrich did that in 1995 in the midterm elections. They lost, and he lost the speakership.
Big time.
Look, the Republicans in the House have voted to defund Obamacare 41 times. The Senate's not going to take it up. As Lou said, the Senate won't take it up. They won't pass it. The president, if they were to pass it, would veto it. So it's not going anyplace. So they're playing a very high-stakes game here. But they're playing a very high-stakes game with the economy, with the threat of government shutdown, and also the debt ceiling limit. You know, they're tying those things together. They cannot they needed to tease it apart, but I think they're playing an extraordinarily dangerous game, not just politically, but I think with the economy as loose.
With our country.
That's
the part. That's what we ought to be talking about, is the problems with our country. This is an important problem. I'm not knocking Obamacare one way or the other, but it isn't going to pass. It isn't going to be there. And let's go and solve the real problems that are out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask, if we drill down to the state level, what impact do you think a shutdown would have on Florida, Lou Fry?
Well, obviously, less money.
You know, less and money, federal dollars.
Federal dollars coming in.
Pension funds. We've got several tens of billions of dollars invested in the market. Those pension funds would be diluted substantially, so it hurts the state employees who are on retirement.
Mm-hmm. And you made that comment before about a 101K. I'm sure that's something, although we joke about it, people are looking at it and saying, this is serious.
Sure. We have a lot of people, like Dick does, we have working with us and so forth, and these things are really important. And again, I'm not knocking Obamacare one way or the other. Frankly, it's not an issue. It is not a player. We've got to play with the real chips on the table. And that's, I guess, if I sound a little frustrated, I probably am.
Well, let me ask you, do you think there'll be some political fallout from this for the people who are putting that roadblock up, like some of the folks in Congress who are throwing up these obstacles that's going to be bad for them politically come the election next year?
Who knows? I think it may actually be good for them. It may be that they have people philosophically who are so locked into it that they think this is a wonderful thing from happening, and it isn't.
Well, let's move on to world affairs. I know that there are other things happening in the U.S. which need attention of lawmakers, but let's just talk briefly about Syria. President Obama is in New York this week to address the United Nations about peace in the Middle East and the August 21st chemical weapons attack in Syria. And so far, it seems that Syria is complying with a tentative diplomatic deal with Russia to destroy its chemical weapons. Lou Fry, do you think this diplomatic approach was the best way to a solution for getting rid of those chemical weapons in Syria?
I think it was a Hail Mary. Mm-hmm. I truly do. We were on a course to shoot some rockets somewhere, some missiles and something, and do it, and there was no other option for it. And all of a sudden, a guy threw us a life raft to climb onto, and we were able to use it diplomatically. And everybody was upset about Putin doing the thing. Well, I'm not a Putin fan in that, but what he did help us and gave us the time to move diplomatically. And so, yeah, maybe we can get a diplomatic solution. We don't want feet in the ground over there, and we need other countries involved with us, like not as many as Bush had in the way back in the first Gulf War, but that kind of an approach. Maybe the United Nations for once will do some good.
Dick Batchelor, do you think this is the way this is playing out? Does it show that President Obama is a little unsure of himself here, or do you think he was just waiting for the right things to be aligned so that he could sort of make this diplomatic move?
The president had what I call Hobson's choices. I mean, he gets first option was to go ahead and bomb, without approval from the Congress. Some people would have criticized that. Secondly, he could have gone to the Congress, so he went to the Congress and people who criticized him for that. And then inadvertently, whatever, there's this conversation now with Putin, because Syria is his sponsored state. And can they work it out? I don't know if they can work it out. Now, somebody in a recent conversation said, isn't that a proverbial fox guarding the hen house? And I said, yes, but remember who eats last, the fox. Mm-hmm. Putin's the fox. I don't trust him. I don't trust Assad.
Yeah, amen.
Assad. So we don't trust him. So do we have to give it time to work? Yes, but parenthetically, let me say this. I still think, though, we still have to increase the arms to the people who are fighting the Assad regime. I think we've got to provide larger arms to them. We can't walk away just removing the chemical weapons. It's just not a full – that doesn't do anything for the people who are fighting the Assad regime. We need to increase it. In fact, last point I'll make is that Putin's now saying, well, you can't threaten to use military force if we don't comply. Well, yes, we can, and I think we should.
Well, you're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm speaking to political commentators Lou Fry and Dick Batchelor. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter. You can also email us at intersection@wmfe.org. Well, let's move back to Florida and talk about the gubernatorial race coming up in 2014. And former Florida Chief Financial Officer Alex Sink, of course, bowing out, announcing she won't run for governor in 2014. And former governor and Democratic favorite at this point, Charlie Crist, yet to announce, stating he'll make a decision in the fall. it seems like we ask this question every month, but does Crist need to announce sooner rather than later?
Well, and I think Lou agree on this. The fact that Charlie Crist has not had name recognition, he's been Commissioner of Education, he's been Attorney General, he's been Governor, he's run for U.S. Senate, he's on every Morgan & Morgan billboard between here and the Florida line up in Jacksonville. So he's got name recognition, so he can afford to hold back. But at some point in time, he's going to have to get in because this governor's prepared, as he said, to raise $100 million. So at some point in time, Charlie's going to get in. I was not surprised very quickly that Alex Sink got out of the race. She wasn't showing fire in the belly. She lost her husband this year, unfortunately. And if you don't have the fire in the belly and you've been through this campaign before and you've got to do fundraising, don't get in the race because it's going to. So yep. Looks like a fait accompli. It might be, Charlie Crist might now be the Democratic choice because he might be the only choice.
Mm-hmm. Not, it's only fire in the belly, as Dick said, but it's also money in the bank. And,
sure.
You know, what you see, and obviously with Alex, as she did it, she tried it. She got a lot of verbal commitments from people and so forth, but no, the money didn't show up either. So when that happens, it's a pretty good poll. You don't have to look at some poll to see that you're in a problem. It'll be interesting, too, because Dick says that there's not a lot of people in the Democratic stable mm-hmm. in terms of looking down the road. What I would suspect would happen, this is just generically in a case like this, is that you do have somebody like Charlie who probably is a leader, but you've got a bunch of people who are at a mid-level, if you will, who are not up at the governor's thing. And somebody's going to sit there in that level and say, hey, this is a free run. Mm-hmm. I'm going to run for name recognition, $3 to $5 million, get my name out there and everything. And maybe, who knows with Charlie, maybe he do well. Maybe he'll quit and run as an independent. You know, you don't really know what's going on. But it might be a place for somebody, you know, who's in the minority leadership or who is looking to run for one of the cabinet positions in that to get out and test themselves. So, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen. But I think whatever happens, Charlie's going to be in the mess.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very good point. You know, Bob Buckhorn, the well-known and very well-liked bipartisan, is in Tampa. Will he run now? And because he might be running for cabinet, and you got the three cabinet members, we all agree, none of the cabinet members, they all desperately frothing at the mouth, want to be governor. But they won't run against the incumbent governor as it is today. But somebody could step out. But it's going to be, if this race is between Crist and Scott, it's going to be a knockdown, drag out Donnybrook of a race, and it's not going to be pretty.
So he's probably wise to be just holding his fire at the moment to keep some money in that war chest.
Well, I think what happened, he's got a book coming out. It's supposed to be a tell-all book, and I think once that book comes out, he needs to start raising money pretty soon. And he's going to have a tough race, but again, he's been in every party there is, and so it's hard for him to stake out the position. On the other hand, if you've taken every position there is available, then maybe it's easy to defend at least one of them.
Yeah. So. Now he can run against himself, and who, you know, wonder if that's ever been done. Right? Wonder if you could file for both the Democrat and the Independent Party.
Interesting.
I don't know.
If you're listening, Charlie Crist. Well, Lou, let me ask you this too. I mean, earlier this month, a Tampa Bay Times article quoted an advisor in the Rick Scott campaign hinting that they could throw some money, some support rather, behind Nan Rich in the Democratic primary in an effort to beat Crist. Do you think Rich stands a chance against Crist in the Democratic primary, even with some GOP help?
No, not really, but we ought to go and ask the congressman from around here who did it in the Democratic primary.
Ellen Grayson,
who used that strategy. Yeah. I think you could. It's one you can use, but I don't think it sells well. And I think you're better off just keeping your campaign going on a positive basis rather than playing games, especially when you can write it your own check for
And I'm glad you mentioned Nan Rich because no one does. I mean, she's actually, I think this was leaks a week, speaking to the FLCO and trying to get some traction there. She's a great lady. She's very bright. She was a Senate minority leader, Democratic leader. And in fact, she was a minority leader in the House. And very knowledgeable, but just can't get traction. And like Lou said, time to time, you need several $1 million just to get your name just on a blip on their radar screen.
Mm-hmm. So it comes down to money. Well, let's move on to something else. Common Core educational standards, national standards in school for mathematics and language arts that aim to better prepare students for college. They've been adopted by 45 states so far, but there's been some opposition mounting in Florida. And as you know, it's Common Core has been championed in Florida by former Republican Governor Jeb Bush, but you have the likes of Senator Marco Rubio saying he's coming out against the initiative. Lou Fry, why do you think this is? Why is Marco Rubio, why is the Tea Party against the Common Core standards?
I really don't know. We have spent, Senator Graham and myself and along with Dick and that, have spent our time trying to get civics taught in Florida as a base, and we were able to do it. And now civics is taught in seventh grade, and you also begin teaching civics in first grade in reading and writing that goes on through. And we didn't seem to have any problem with the standards in that and getting it done. We're going to have something like 1.5 million people through that program in about 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. So if they want to have standards and so forth, fine. It looks to me that's sort of like an intramural fight going on.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. I mean, you clearly have some ideas about what Central Florida should be doing to attract better jobs, better futures for the young folks, including the simulation industry.
Yeah, we're having the 22nd semiannual symposium on the 30th of the month. Dick's on the board. And the basic issue is simulation. And what we're doing is exposing the young people to simulation. It's not just a military thing. There's plenty of other uses for it. It's hospitals, it's education, it's trucking, it's flying, whole bunch of different things for young people and opening it up to them. And we're doing something that's never been done before, and I hope it works, is we've got five different rooms set up. And every half hour, the young people, there'll be different groups, like Group A, the green group, will go to one thing, and they'll all go around, so they'll have a chance not only to look at it, but to see it. Maybe we can get a job bank out of this thing. You know, with all the companies out there and everything, we don't have a job bank in that. And so I look at it, I look what happened to the space program, and I look where the space program isn't today. The simulation industry has to stake itself out, understand we're just not the center for simulation here. We're basically national and international. Mm-hmm. We are the number one in simulation. We got to keep it. We got all the military here. So it's a great community-wide effort. It's not political. Senator Nelson's going to speak, and Congressman Mike is going to speak. It's a total bipartisan deal, and it's exciting, and it's great to have 400 or 500 kids, high school kids, running around and talking about something that really can make a difference in their future.
Well, just one final point. We've been talking about this a little bit before, but the City of Orlando and Orlando City Soccer marching towards an MLS franchise in the city. And as you know, Mayor Dyer's been working with county leadership to lock in some funding, purchasing land for what will be an $85 million stadium. And then there's a few million on top of that for the cost of the land, of course. Almost all the land's been purchased, but there's a couple of holdouts, and Mayor Dyer has said that if necessary, he will use eminent domain to obtain the land. Do you think this is a smart move on his part?
Well, you got to be careful. There's a great Supreme Court decision on eminent domain, and it's got to be very, very specific. It's got to be – it used to be you could go use eminent domain to acquire land for almost any purposes, but now it has got to be defined as a public interest and a public purpose under a Supreme Court ruling. So I think you have to be careful when you suggest that you're going to use eminent domain for taking in one's personal property, real property.
It could be you certainly used as a strategy of negotiations and talking about it when it comes back. And, you know, it's a good use. Baseball, minor league baseball is something that we've never been able to do here, and we got a stadium down there for it. We have lights, but the lights don't work. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think all that adds to, and it's important that we do the other side of it, the intellectual side, the opera. You know, and those things are all in part because any great city has got that. It's just not it's just not the Pittsburgh Pirates, you know, or something. It's a whole bunch of things that go into making our town something that companies want to bring their people into. Mm-hmm. They want to come. They want to look at it. They can do all these other things and enjoy the nice weather. So I hope it works, but I hope it works through negotiations.
And one point I want to make, too, I think when you go and ask for resort tax for money and you get – the county commission's agreed to that, and Mayor Teresa Jacobs agreed to that, and you put up some money, and the private owners put up money. But Lou is a lawyer, and they do a lot of land work, so he'll be the better judge of this. But when you get into eminent domain, it's a quasi-judicial process. You have discovery, you have depositions, and you have to have proof. You can't surmise the economic development impact will be X. You have got to prove it's X. So eminent domain is extraordinarily different than a political process. It's quasi-judicial. And it's all driven on
and
fact.
How about lengthy?
And lengthy and expensive.
And it seems like they want to get through this process pretty quickly and get on to building that stadium. So maybe that'll be a drawback. Well, Lou Fry, thank you for coming in. Lou Fry, of course, a former Republican congressman and an attorney at Lowndes, Drostick, Doster, Cantor and Reed. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
And also Dick Batchelor, former Democratic State House representative and head of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Thanks for coming in as well.
Great to be back.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. You can join the conversation online on Facebook or Twitter. You can also send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. Up next, a conversation with Misty Cash from the Florida Department of Corrections and Lynn Schwatsky from Sesame Street about Little Children, Big Challenges, a program to help children with incarcerated parents. Joining me from the Florida Department of Corrections is Misty Cash. She's the Deputy Communications Director of the department. Misty, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And on the line by phone as well from the Sesame Street Workshop is Lynn Schwatzky. She's the Vice President of Outreach Initiatives and Partnership for Sesame Street Workshop. Thank you very much for joining us too, Lynn.
Thanks for having me as well.
Well, Misty, let me start with you. 1 in 28 children have a parent in the federal prison system across the United States. I mean, that's quite a high number. And in Florida, around 64,000 Florida inmates have a child under 18 years old. Before this pilot program that you're part of, were there resources available for those children?
We didn't have anything as wonderful as this, and it wasn't anything that the children really identified with. I mean, most all kids know Big Bird and Cookie Monster, and they understand those characters and how they communicate. So this was a wonderful, wonderful resource for that population of children. And that 64,000 is only a number of inmates who self-report those children. So we know that there's thousands more out there.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you able to just describe quickly for our listeners what the program is and how it differs from what kind of resources might have been out there in the past?
Well, for us, Sesame Street developed this wonderful parent resource kit. And so the tools in it have things not just for the kids, but for the caregiver of that child while their parent is incarcerated, and tools for the inmate themselves. So the kit has a DVD for the kids to watch, and it's their Sesame Street characters that they know and that they're used to. And the kit has some tip sheets for the caregiver on how to help the child as they're going through this process of understanding. And then it has a tip sheet for the inmate on tips and ways they can communicate with their child while they're away.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lynn, I want to bring you in the conversation now. Sesame Street's been working on several different initiatives as part of their Little Children Big Challenges program, and this pilot program is included as part of that. And some of those other programs include things like programs for children in military families and also children of divorced parents. So you're tackling some pretty big and spiky issues there. Where do the ideas for these programs come from?
Work that you're talking about, kids who have a parent in the military, kids whose parents come back injured with either a physical or an invisible injury, children who grieve their parents' death, divorce and incarceration. This all falls under how do you help children develop resilient skills mm-hmm. to cope with these challenging transitions in their lives. And it is our hope that all of this work is building and helping these children. So whether it's these topics or even other topics, that they can really tackle these topics through the support, of course, of their family, of their caregivers, of the adults in their lives.
Do you think there's a tendency now in the media or just in society in general to try and tackle these topics head on? I wonder if 40 years ago people might have been a little bit hesitant to put up a program on television about which deals with topics like divorce. It seems like that might be something you would try and just kind of cover up rather than really face head on and try and talk to children directly about that.
You know, I think the reason why, what our point of difference is and why we truthfully are so successful in this work is that we are not using the medium of television to address these issues. We are creating media, but we are actually working with partners like Misty, like community partners that are reaching these families directly. We are empowering them with tools that they can go directly and work with families. Mm-hmm. So it's not that we're putting it on a television screen and saying, hey, everybody out there, you can watch this and do what you want with it. We are giving tools to the people working with families. We're also training these folks, and we're giving them the opportunity to really dive deeper into these subject matters and into this content.
I'm speaking to Lynn Schwatzky. She's the Vice President of Outreach Initiatives and Partnership from the Sesame Street Workshop, also joined by Misty Cash, the Deputy Communications Director from the Florida Department of Corrections. We're talking about a new initiative to help children whose parents are incarcerated here in Florida. Misty, I want to ask you, did you find or were you seeing a demand from some of the those incarcerated parents for some kind of resource kit like this before this came about?
Yes, we're lucky to have wonderful volunteers across our state and in our institutions. And in very few institutions, those volunteers did have some programs that helped inmates relate to still feel like they're caring for and providing for their children. However, it was nothing that was statewide, and it was really mostly for our female inmates. So when Sesame Street approached us about this, it was an amazing opportunity to really allow each and every inmate, all 100,000 plus, to find a way to use this information and these resources to communicate and still care for their children while they're incarcerated.
Now, you mentioned before 100,000 inmates in Florida all up. Am I right in that figure?
100,000 plus, yes.
So, I mean, that's a pretty big number. And as you say, Florida has one of the highest prison populations in the U.S., obviously partly because of the sheer size of the state. But nonetheless, I'm wondering, a program like this, do you think that it will help address something of the question of whether children of those incarcerated run a higher risk of being incarcerated later down the track when they become adults? Is that something that this program kind of looks to address or you think might help in heading that off at the pass?
Yes, we do hope that it's something that heads things off at the pass. We hope that by really having the tools and the help to explain to children what incarceration is, what it means to them in terms of their parent or loved one not being able to be with them, we hope that they will see that, you know, this is not the direction I want to go. I want to make sure that, you know, I love my mom and dad, I love my aunt or uncle, but I want to make sure that I don't come to this place. And so we really do hope that it does prevent any cycle of those children going down the wrong path and ending up where their loved one is.
And just a final question, Lynn Trotsky, I'm wondering, is there another target group you're looking at? You mentioned children of folks in the military as well, children of parents who are divorcing. Is there some other project you're looking at in the future where you're going to design a package of resources for children to help them get through a difficult situation, or is this at this point?
You know, we are constantly evaluating, assessing the needs of children here in this country as well as all over the world. And we have a group here. That's what they do. They continually to see where is a group that is really in need of resources around a specific area, and can we, this brand, this organization, create media tools to really address those needs. So when that, and if that comes up, which it does often, we will look at doing the work, and we'll be happy to share it with you when and if that time comes.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking to Lynn Trotsky. She's the Vice President of Outreach Initiatives and Partnerships from the Sesame Street Workshop. Lynn, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me and your interest in this work.
And also, we've been speaking to Misty Cash. She's the Deputy Communications Director, and she works for the Florida Department of Corrections. We've been speaking about the new Sesame Street Workshop project to help the children of incarcerated parents. Thank you very much, Misty.
Thank you for having us.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.